You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Hi, everyone. How are you? Thanks for tuning in again. If this is your first time, you're in for a treat. I think so. If it is your first time, I ask you to subscribe to the podcast. Give it a listen. Give other guests a chance because you might not know them, but you might just learn something from them. I know I learn a little every day. It's therapy for me. It's free therapy. That's what it is. And hopefully it's a little therapy for you. But I'll tell you what, today's guest was, we'll get into the guest. It was extraordinary. And, you know, I was nervous about this one. You hear me say that occasionally, but, you know, I know Kevin, but I don't know Kevin Conroy, the voice of Batman over all these years. And we did Justice League Unlimited together. But he was so open. I was nervous that he didn't want to get personal, and I'll tell you what, I learned so much. I know you will too. And it's heart-wrenching. Some of it is really like some of it's beautiful. Some of it's, you know, talk about facing adversity. You listen to his story and you're going to, I think you're going to really not only appreciate him more, but appreciate life more, appreciate, maybe learn something from it. I think you will. Also, I've said it before, great guests coming up as well. There's a couple that I was really excited about getting. And I think they're going to be really, really swell. All my guests are amazing and they open up and I just really appreciate it. Last week, Oliver Hudson. If you haven't listened to Oliver Hudson and you don't know him or whatever, listen to it. Trust me. Talk about somebody who opens up about, it's like my sister, Kate Hudson's a movie star. My mom, Goldie Hawn's a movie star. Kurt Russell, my dad's a movie star. And I, at this point in his life, he was like, I'm anxious. What am I doing? I'm not. And he was just so honest about things. Meeting up with his biological father, which some people out there in the world can relate to. And check that out. And if you haven't listened to Eli Roth, by the way, another one, director, even if you don't like horror, very insightful. He was the Bear Jew in Inglourious Basterds. He directed Hostel, Cabin Fever, so many things. Check him out. I want to say a big thanks to, of course, all my listeners out there. It means a great deal for you to tune in every week. I say it every week, but I should because you never know if there are new listeners here, and you hope there are. But please subscribe. You can watch on YouTube. Ryan does a lovely job editing. Follow us on Instagram. At Inside of You Podcast on Instagram and Facebook at Inside of You Pod, I believe on Twitter. I should know that by now. You know, obviously I had to cancel my live podcast with Zach Levi in Texas, but that's par for the course. There's things going on in this world that are out of my control. And I think that's part of like this whole process is just sort of saying, hey, it's out of your control. Let it go. Why are you stressed? Why are you irritable? Why are you just, you know, let it go, you know? So this past week was a little bit tough for me. I had one day where nothing worked, the internet didn't work, and this company's been just screwing me over. Of course, that's how you feel, like they're screwing me over, but you know, obviously a lot of people are having problems. But I had to cancel two guests right when they're about to record, which upsets me because I'm always on time. I always want to do things right, and I sometimes my friend says, dude, things happen, life happens, you just gotta hope that the person you're about to talk to is cool and understands, and most people will understand. So thank you to my guests a few days ago that I had to postpone. But great podcast. I did 5 interviews this last week, and they're fantastic. And I wish I could tell you the good news. There's some good news coming. I've been saying it, but I'll be announcing it soon. Really excited about that. And thanks to my sponsor, BetterHelp. I think it's very fitting for this show. BetterHelp online counseling. They didn't even ask me to say this in the beginning, but I noticed that it does help people and any kind of counseling during these times, especially, and all the time. To talk to someone is just so valuable. Another huge shout out to my patrons. I don't know if you know what Patreon is. I talk about it all the time, but people who love the podcast, they support on the side, they pledge, they get a bunch of stuff. There's tiers, there's a community. The biggest thing I've known, I do these Instagram lives, and I noticed that people have built these friendships from this community of Patreon, and people keep joining. And you know, I keep thinking, oh, they love the podcast, and I'm thinking, well, I think they actually like each other too. It's fantastic, and I thank you all for sticking around and being a part of this. We do Inside of Me, where they get to ask me questions. I created another character who asks the questions. It's a woman. Sometimes it's a dude. I just like to mix it up. I get bored, man. I have to be creative. There's a lot of other stuff, shit talking questions where they ask the guest questions, and extra podcast bonus ep for people. Sometimes there's old episodes that aren't even around that we dig up and we give to our patrons. And there's a great community. We talk, we do YouTube lives where I play music and they have a request line. It's just for all the patrons for that one. And it's amazing. And the support is unreal. So if you're interested in joining the community, I definitely recommend Patreon. And a lot of the people on there that I consider friends, really, could speak for themselves, and they would say probably the same thing. I want to get into it. Is there anything else I wanted to talk about? I also want to thank Hint Water. Hint doesn't even ask me. They just give me these waters for a couple of years now. My buddy Paul, he just delivers waters, and it's nice. And they don't ever ask, hey, put it on the podcast, talk about it. They don't give me money. I just love Hint Water. I just want to say Hint Water. Thanks. You get the hint? Good. Great. Let's get into the podcast. Afterwards, I'll be talking about some other stuff, but let's get into it. This guy is the voice of Batman for many years. I've had the luck to work with him. He's a great man. He lived with Robin Williams. He's been around in a good way. He's just so knowledgeable and so open. I think you're going to love the crap out of this one. Let's get inside of Kevin Conroy.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
You know, Conroy, I'm going to blame you on this.
I know.
It just has to be.
Computers don't like me. I don't know what it is. I like computers. Anything that can go wrong will go wrong.
Well, I'm telling you, right before we called, I was going a little... You know, I don't get... It's not so much external, just inside I get this... In here, in the chest, and I start.
It's called anxiety.
Yeah, but it's the simple things. It's like, why am I freaking out inside? Why am I getting all worried about things? I hate when it happens.
I know. Yeah, I know. That's human.
Do you do it? Do you still get, do you ever get, you seem so calm and collected, right?
It's a really good mask, isn't it?
Well,
I've been meditating since I was 21.
21. Is it something that's part of your routine every day when you wake up, or is it a...
It was for decades. It was much more necessary when I was younger. I was very anxiety ridden. I was really in knots inside. And I really needed that tool. I ran 6 miles every day. I did everything I could to release anxiety because... I grew up with an incredible amount of anxiety tied up inside of me. And I really had to focus for a while when I was younger to get rid of that, to get that out of my life.
It's amazing that at a young age, you can actually understand. You knew what was happening to you, right? You knew that there's something going on that's just that I have to try and do everything I can to control it.
Oh, absolutely. I was drinking too much. I was doing drugs. I was smoking a pack a day. And I was having seizures. I had something called psychomotor epilepsy that started when I was about 14. And I'd have fits. And they did all kinds of brain scans. And they said, you do not have epilepsy. But you have a psychological condition called long-term anxiety. And it comes from growing up in a situation of such anxiety, such tension, that your nervous system has this valve that you've developed. And it's giving you these seizures. And it was really dramatic. I mean, I once flew off my bicycle. I once fell off a roof. I would have these seizures. And so I had to do everything I could to alleviate anxiety.
Well, do you think, obviously, but do you think it stemmed from maybe just upbringing and being around dysfunction at all?
Oh, God. It was all about that. My father was a fall down drunk, and he was a mean drunk, and he was a old world, very imperious man. He was a child of immigrants. He grew up in Hell's Kitchen in New York. He was an entirely self-made man. He was a street kid in New York, and a really tough one. And he was born in 1910. So it was like having a grandfather. You know, he was much older. And he was very old world, old Irish. And everything had to be very formal. We were little, we had to call him sir, stuff like that. And the fights in our house growing up were just legendary. It was like growing up in Long Day's Journey into Night. I mean, it was just this Irish, drunk, crazy, fighting clan. All my older siblings were fighting with my father. And my mother was very, very much like Mary Tyrone in Long Day's Journey. She was very passive. She was very loving, but just beaten down by this man that she'd been married to. And everyone got out of that house as soon as they could. All my older siblings, who were much older. And so by the time I got to be around 14, I was there alone. And it was insane in that house. I mean, that day, my father was drunk every day. And my mother started drinking heavily. And I ended up moving out of that house when I was 16 and moved in with a friend's family just so I could finish high school.
And they let you?
Stay there. You could not live there. It was the police were there all the time. It was crazy.
Wow. So it was screaming, it was yelling, it was physical, it was alcohol, it was everything.
Everything.
My God. You know?
It's kind of a classic, you know, it's not that unusual.
It is. Hang on a second.
Fortunately, it's not that unusual.
Well, I talk about some dysfunction that I had. People talk about their dysfunctions, but then you always hear someone else's story and you're like, that was fine. Yeah. I mean, listen to Kevin. I mean, Kevin really had it bad. I feel better. I don't feel better. I feel horrible for you, but I just like it. You know, I talk about this all the time, but it is, you see, I'm sure you have friends or people that like, oh, I actually grew up in a normal environment. My parents didn't drink. They were kind. They were loving. They're still together. And I envy that.
Oh, I am in awe of families like that. Like, right? You know who's like that? You know who's like that?
Who?
Dietrich Bader.
And you could tell.
I love that family. He and his wife and these two kids, they adore each other. They are happy together. You go into that house and it's just functioning, loving, warm. And you sit there and you think, this really does exist. You know, I never saw that growing up. So I love that family. They were wonderful people.
Yeah. And it's so funny because I find myself being comforted by going over friends' houses who have families who are together, who are loving, and just going for dinner or spending, like, it's me and their family. It's like Lonely Rosenbaum.
Yeah.
And I go there, and I think I did that as a kid. I would go to, the Cutters down the street, even though they were dysfunctional, but, you know, they were kind of loving, and the Idlemans and the Shepherds, and I would just try to, I don't, what is that?
I don't know. It's another world. But yeah, I moved in with the Emmanuels, who was a classmate of mine in high school, just so I could finish up high school, because my house was insane, completely insane.
What did your family think about that, though? Were they like, okay, go, stay there, it's fine?
Well, my mother was happy about it because she moved out at that point, moved in with her sister in upstate New York to get away from my father. My father, it was a very, very dark time in our lives. He had tried to kill himself and he was committed for a while. And when he was released, he moved back into the house and the police had told him he wasn't supposed to and he just showed up. And so my mother and I got out. It was crazy. I mean, this is like, they write books about this kind of stuff. I never talk about this with anyone because it's just so, it's so ridiculous. You think, wasn't there anyone around to protect these people? And this is, you know, the 1970s, there really wasn't.
But how long?
The police got tired of coming to our house. You know, it was that kind of thing. Because no one was going to kill anybody. It was just all this insanity. And so my mother got out. I got out. And then I got a scholarship to go to Juilliard. And I moved into New York when I was 17. And I've been supporting myself ever since. I never went back.
Hang on. It says my internet connection is unstable. This is the shit I deal with constantly. So we're going to keep going.
Okay.
All right. So all the crap. And then you ended up moving. You went to Juilliard. So by the way, during this whole time, was your father sort of like anti-acting? No son of mine's going to be an actor.
Oh, he thought it was completely insane. He couldn't understand it. he just, but he had so checked out at that point that he was really at the bottom. I mean, he tried to kill himself when I was in high school. I mean, it was just, it was very ugly. And and at that time, I was the only one left in the house with my mother. So I was the one sent to see him in the hospital and pick up his car, which was covered with blood. I mean, it was, for a 16-year-old, it was just a truly dark, dark experience that I couldn't get away from fast enough.
Oh. So, how do you get away from that? How do you?
My point is, he didn't have any say in what I was going to do, especially because he wasn't going to pay for anything. I was getting a scholarship. And it's funny, John Houseman, the day I auditioned for Juilliard, I was 17, I'm auditioning on the main stage at Juilliard, and I'm doing Romeo, you know. And afterwards, John Houseman says, "Well, Mr. Conroy, we're clearly very interested in having you come to Juilliard." And I was so excited. And he said, "Come up and speak to Miss Hawley about her finances." No. First he said, "How is it a young man from Westport needs financing?" And I said, "Well, not everyone from Westport is wealthy, A. And B, I don't have a family that will support me." And he said, "Oh, very, very well, very well. It's none of my business. But come up and speak to Miss Harley. And there was a moat at the bottom of the stage. And the audience was actually above us. And it was like called this a studio theater. And it was set up like an operating room with the first row, you know, was above you looking down. Right. So when you're watching performances, it was like viewing an operating room. But I was on this stage and I grabbed a bar that was about at eye level. And I used to do gymnastics in high school. And I grabbed the bar and I vaulted from the stage up into the first row without even thinking. And Houseman and Harley jumped up and said, "Good God, you're not insured yet."
Oh, my God.
And I don't know how I did it. I just bolted. And that's when they said they'd give me a scholarship.
What year was that?
73.
Because what year was he doing the paper chase? I remember as a kid just watching.
Good evening. It was right after that. Well, I was there before he started his acting career. Because he had been a producer and a director. He was more of an impresario.
Right.
And he started acting really late. He started acting after that.
Yeah, because then he did like a Ghost Story and all these different things.
Yeah.
Wow. Did your dad ever, by the way, did he ever see you perform?
Yes.
Did he ever say, "Hey, you're good. I'm proud of you"?
No.
None of that.
None of that.
And you wanted that.
But he came to see me. I was doing Death Trap. I did the national tour, the Broadway tour. And we were playing at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. I was co-starring with Brian Bedford. And it was a big role. It was a wonderful role. And he came up to see the play. And he really didn't say anything.
Which is the
he
worst.
He just wanted to... He wanted to meet Brian backstage, and when Brian met him after the show, Brian was a very difficult man, very difficult, but a brilliant actor and a generous, he had a generous soul and he liked me, but he could be really difficult. And he, the next night after my father had come, Brian, summoned me to his dressing room, you know, because he was the star. So I went to his dressing room and he said, "I'd like to talk to you about your father." And I said, "Oh, great." He said, "I sensed a lot of tension between you." And I said, "Yeah, there's a lot of history there." He said, "He's a very unusual man." I said, "Yes, he's very unusual." And he said, "Let me give you a piece of advice. When your father dies, which he eventually will, you will never get a chance to correct that relationship. And that will haunt you for the rest of your life." He said, "So my advice to you is do everything you can while he's alive to try and mend that bridge.
Oh my God. I know, because I've been there with my father.
But it's so true. And I did. I ended up taking care of my father in his last years. Did everything. I mean, I was flying back and forth between New York and LA because he kept getting put in drunk wards and stuff. And I was the only one of my siblings who was doing any of this. And they'd say, why are you doing this? He was a monster. Why are you? And I kept thinking of Brian. So I was with my father the night he died. And that's an invaluable thing to have, to know that you gave 100%, that you did everything humanly possible to save this man, to reach this man. And so I have no ghosts at all.
My God, I mean, honestly, you brought me to tears almost. I'm just like sitting here. My God, that is
wonderful. I had an amazing moment with him on his last night. Because I didn't think he was going to die that night. Because he had come close to the edge so many times. And the doctor met me in the hall. He said, oh, we're so glad you flew in from L.A. We may not make it through the night. I said, are you serious? I thought this was just another drunk thing. He said, oh, no, his system is closing down.
Wow.
I was with him. And we're sitting there in the dark of this hospital room. And he looked out through the hospital window into the night sky. And he got this really distant stare. They call the 1,000-yard stare.
Right. Or more.
And he just shook his head and he said, the great Conroy. So remorsefully, so ruefully. And I said, what was that, Dad? And he didn't look at me. He just kept shaking his head. And he said, the great Conroy. And I thought, dear God in heaven, this is the best lesson he's ever given me. How not to die. You don't want to live your life so that at the last breath you have, you're thinking, I've wasted my life.
Oh, my God.
Which is what he was thinking. That's exactly what he was. And I thought, this is an invaluable lesson. Isn't that amazing?
Oh, my God. It was an amazing moment. I mean, I was just tense this whole time listening.
Oddly enough, it was the closest moment we'd ever had.
Do you think he was obviously talking about himself, like, I'm shit. I ruined my life. That's what it was.
Yes. I've wasted my life. Who did I think I was? What was I trying to prove?
So inadvertently, he gave you the best advice of your life, almost on his last breath.
Oh, absolutely.
And you felt it. You knew it right then. Were you emotional? Were you brought to tears at this moment?
I was. That ended up being a very emotional night. Because it was so unexpected. And at that point, I was the one holding the family together. I was the diplomat. I was running my father's, you know, house and his accounts for him. And I had to contact all of my siblings.
Which is the hardest thing to do. I had to do it with my grandma. Isn't that the worst? That's the worst part, having to tell each person. Well, maybe. I don't. Was it?
Oh, yeah. I have a brother who's mentally ill. And I, having to tell him was just, he fell apart. He completely fell apart.
How many years ago was that?
I was 30. So it was 86. So it's 34 years ago. Something like
that. And I'm feeling that you're feeling this like it was yesterday.
It was a very visceral experience. It was a pivotal time tonight, too, because I knew that I was going to take over from my brother at that point. I was going to be responsible for him from then on, which I was. Oh. And so it was a big transition, which I had been preparing for.
Did you ever call Brian and say, you know, I did it. I took your advice.
Mm-mm. You know, I didn't. Isn't that terrible?
No.
Brian and I really did drifted apart. I learned so much from him on stage. And I also learned from him off stage, like that example. but he could be so difficult to live with that we didn't really get along. So we had some famous fights on stage, actually, during the performance.
Like almost these subtle moments that only you and he knew about?
Oh, no.
Like what?
Like the opening at the Kennedy Center, which is a state event because it's part of the, you know, it's a national monument, the Kennedy Center. So people are there in like black tie and stuff.
Right.
And Brian could be such a prick on stage. He was such a diva. And Death Trap is about these two writers who were sort of dueling with each other. And there's many, many layers to the play. I don't want to get into it now. It's hard to describe. But there are points where one writer finds what the other writer has been writing and reads it aloud. So you're basically reading a lot of exposition that the audience has already seen because it's like a play within a play within a play. So it's very difficult to keep the audience's interest because they've already seen all this stuff. And I had the first one of these speeches. And during it, Brian became just riveted by something on the rug. And he started going down on his all fours on the rug, trying to find something. And the audience knew exactly what he was doing, and they started laughing. He was just stealing focus. And he was just being ruthless about it and totally ignoring me. And I got louder and louder. It was driving me crazy. And then I calmed down. And then his turn came in the next scene to do the same thing, to have to read an expository.
Don't tell me you got on the floor.
He had learned. No. I turned around and there was a bookcase behind me. And I started looking for books in the bookcase, and I was taking them out and looking at them. I just couldn't look, and I couldn't find what I wanted. And he was getting louder and more strident, trying to get my attention. And I was ignoring him, and the audience knew exactly what I was doing. And they were howling that I was giving him back exactly what he'd given me. And just at that moment, I was turning back to him, and he was getting ready to swat me in the head with the script. You know, we've found a script that each of us is working on. So just as I'm turning, this script comes and bashes me in the face, and the rivet from the script grazes my eye. And I thought he had really hurt me, and I went crazy. And we're on either side of this big lawyer's partner desk, and I lunged for him. And he threw down the script, and he lunged for me. And we heard Murray Gitlin, the stage manager from the wings, say, gentlemen, please, this is the theater.
On stage. This is the packed performance.
We're like,
oh my God.
We had to sit back in our chairs. And we were doing all of this through the lines of the play. We never stopped saying the lines of the play. So the whole thing, you know, we're doing this play and we're like, I want to kill you. And that was the subtext was, I want to kill you. And then we both sit down and we got through the scene. And the playwright, Ira Levin, who also wrote Rosemary's Baby and big playwright, had come down from New York with his family for the Kennedy Center opening. And he was in the audience.
And he loved it. No.
I thought, I am so fired. I am never going to work in the theater again. This is my first big job after Juilliard. This is my first big break. I'm out. They're going to blackball me. He comes to my dressing room and he says, you were brilliant. It was incredible. It was like watching Hamlet. Where did you find all that in my play?
So you guys, they thought it was part of it?
Yeah, we kept saying the lines. We were just playing it, this hostile anger, fury at each other, but we'd never broken out of character.
And what did he say anything afterwards? Like, I'm sorry.
No, Brian didn't know how to say I'm sorry.
You know, I think if you notice any similarities in someone that your father might have had or drinking or things, are there certain things, triggers that you're like, can't be around that person. That's something that's too much for me. I can't deal with that.
Selfishness to the point of narcissism, I find impossible to be around. And when someone like that comes into my life, I tend to cut them out and distance myself from them. I just don't even try to deal with them because there's no cure for narcissism, for that kind of selfishness. I have no patience for it.
It's just amazing how you could have easily went downhill and said, you know, poor me, and sort of with your upbringing. I mean, a lot of people do. They just go, you go one way or the other, right? It's the hand of fate. You make choices. It is a choice.
Oh, absolutely. I made a very conscious choice when I was 21 to stop drinking, stop drugging, stop smoking. Because once I got out of that house, oddly enough, when I was 17 and I got an apartment, I was living in New York. I was, Robin Williams was my roommate. I was at Juilliard with the most amazing actors who were all much older than me. And they were such incredibly talented people. I felt so out of my league. And I started drinking. You'd think after what I saw growing up, it would be the last thing I would do. But it was just like, it was like quicksand pulling me in. It was this irresistible force. And the smoking. And I just realized on my 21st birthday, I thought, it is sink or swim. You have one choice to make. You can live, or you can slowly kill yourself the way your parents did.
You felt that way. You felt that strongly. Like, this is it. Because you were a big drinker, right? When you were drinking, it wasn't just one drink. You drank.
I drank, starting at like 17. So 21, I stopped everything.
Yeah, that's amazing. That takes an incredible willpower. I've never been a drinker, but, you know, it's hard for me not to have a smoke every once in a while. It's hard for me not to smoke a little pot every once in a while. Well, three times a week. You know, it's, you know, I have the demons, man. I definitely, we all do. And it's just how, you know, sometimes the older you get, you're just like, oh, I want to feel like I felt when I was in my 20s, that, you know, you just didn't care and you were indestructible and you had endless energy and you didn't feel about, you didn't think about, oh, it's going to be a 15-hour day on set. You didn't care. You're like, you didn't think about hours.
You didn't even register. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now it just seems like, how long is that going to take? How long do I have to be that? How long is it? Do you see that? Do you do that?
God, of course. Yeah. But the whole aging thing is so weird because it creeps up on you. I mean, there's this wonderful Groucho Marx line that LA is the only place in the world where you fall asleep by the pool and you wake up and you're 87. I love that image because it's so true, because there's no sense of seasons, that you just turn around and suddenly you're 10 years older, 15 years older, and you think, what happened?
Yeah.
But life is like that too. Like describing that moment at the Kennedy Center with Brian that I was describing to you. I was living it again. I was right in it. To me, that happened yesterday. And yet, that was over 40 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm older than I look.
You look great.
I don't.
You do look great. Are you kidding? You have so much energy. I mean, look, you said, I don't have time for narcissism. I don't have time for this. I'm living my life. Your father, when he said the great Conroy, you know, what went through your mind, and you know exactly what it meant. He wasted his life, and I'm not going to do that. I mean, these are all obviously, they're singing in my head. It really makes me think. But is it something that you have to think about almost all the time to just make sure you're living in the moment, to make sure you're going day by day and not rushing through it?
Yeah, I do. I have to remind myself all the time. I hate that. I hate having to relearn a lesson that I've learned 5, 10, 20 times. Learning, you're going through it again and you think, I've been here before. I knew this already. And yet I'm here again.
Right.
There was a wonderful book that came out, I was like 40 years ago, called Prisoners of Childhood. And it was re-released as under a different title. But it was by a psychologist who wrote that we spend our lives repeating the cycles that are established in childhood and trying to correct them.
Yes.
We spend our lives doing that. Because you don't correct it the first time. You keep coming back to that and keep trying to make it perfect. But I'm much less anxious than I used to be. Much less. I got that down to a tolerable level.
That's very important.
Yeah.
Do you, I know you go through this because you go to the conventions and I've seen you at signings. We were in Ireland together in Dublin. And, you know, people are constantly saying, you know, for me, they're like, oh, say I am the villain of the story. Do you hear, you know, I'm Batman. I want to hear that. You hear it all the time, right? So I'm sure look, you love it, but you've done it so much. Do you have to remind yourself when you're getting annoyed that this is just a gift that you just have to suck it up? I mean, it's got to get annoying sometimes.
That doesn't get annoying because I know how lucky I am.
Good.
What gets annoying is when people get really intrusive about something, and that's when I have to take a breath and remind myself how lucky I am and to not react. I was at a con recently, and I was sitting waiting for a car, I think, to pick me up. And this guy was just standing in front of me with a camera and just kept following me with the camera, just wouldn't stop following me with the camera. And I said, excuse me, I'm off now. You know, I'm going home. And he wouldn't stop. And he just kept it on. And finally, I snapped him. I said, would you turn that fucking thing off? And as soon as I did it, I thought, okay, that's the moment that's going to go on Instagram or something. You know, that's the moment that's going to
get. Did it go on there?
No, it never did. But I was so sure it would, because he would just pushed and pushed. And if he got the reaction he wanted, you know, and I fell into it. Because I just felt my space was so invaded.
Right.
But I have such great fans. I have such incredible support from the fans that I am so appreciative when they come to the cons. I love going to the cons.
Yeah, I do too. I think you and I mean, I don't think everybody loves it.
You do. You're great with the fans. I've watched you. You're great.
Oh, thank you.
Not everybody is.
Really? I guess I don't notice because I just want to have fun and, I think it's just part of me. It's just part of my personality. It's just like I'm here. And it's exhausting. And that's part of my personality that, even though I like that part about me, there's many parts I don't like, but certainly when I'm on set and I'm working, I always feel like in between I'm laughing, I'm joking, I'm doing it, and I exhaust myself.
Yeah.
All of the other actors go to their trailers and they rest. Kevin Conroy goes and he reads a script or a book or takes a nap. Not Michael Rosenbaum. He's hanging out with the grips and the fucking set design. Hey, guys.
Everyone loves you.
Yes, but it's torturing me.
I am this hermit because I'm back in my room reading a book.
Inside of You is brought to you by Rocket Money. I love Rocket Money. You know why? Because everyone should have Rocket Money because it just helps you save money. How many times do we have subscriptions that we don't even know we have anymore and we're paying so much money? It's just throwing away money, Ryan.
I found one.
You did it. You told me. I got Rocket Money.
Okay, I found one. I'm embarrassed to say how long it's been going on, but thank you for finding it. My God. It was embarrassing.
Yeah, because it's like you want to watch some show and you go, I have to subscribe to this this streaming whatever. Mm-hmm. And you start streaming the show, you watch it, you leave, and you forget after this trial period it kicks in and it's charging terrible. You $10 a month. It is embarrassing.
Ugh.
You know, 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about. Before I started using Rocket Money, I thought I had, I have like 5 subscriptions. I could not believe it when they showed me I was paying for like 4 extra between, streaming devices and fitness apps, delivery services. It's never ending. And thanks to Rocket Money, I'm no longer wasting money on the ones I forgot about. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features.
Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lowering your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. And I like that.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/inside. That's rocketmoney.com/inside. rocketmoney.com/inside.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Macy's, Adidas, Walmart, Nike, Wine.com, Samsung, Lenovo, Sephora, and more. And even stack sales on top of cashback. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
You know, here's a good question. I'm going to compliment myself before I ask it. Here's a good question. You know, no, it's not. It's one of those things. I mean, look at you, Juilliard, and you've done all these plays and worked with the greatest. And so, and then who would ever thought you'd become this this extensive voiceover career like that? That's like has made you famous in so many ways, right?
What was the likelihood of a New York actor who primarily did classics? I worked for Joe Papp at the Public, San Diego Shakespeare, Hartford Stage. I did a lot of regional theater, did a lot of theater on Broadway and off Broadway. But a classically trained actor, what were the odds of the first animated audition he's invited to do is the animation of Batman? The first audition I went on. For a voiceover.
And you didn't even want to audition for that role.
I wanted to audition for Bullock. Because I thought those are the character, you know, I could be a really good character. I thought that'd be a more fun character. And because of the kind of roles I played, Edgar in Lear, Edmund in Lear, Achilles, Orestes, Prince Hal, all of these classic epic heroes, that the one role they would want me to read for is Batman, who is, of all the DC characters, of all the animated universe, he is a classic Shakespearean type of actor. His whole life drama is a Greek drama. I mean, it's so epic. It's so...
His parents killed.
It's a Greek drama. When Bruce Timm was describing to me the character, because the only Batman I knew was the Adam West Batman from the 60s. And Bruce Timm said, no, that's not what we're doing. Everyone loves Adam West, but that's not what we're doing. He said, no, and he described to me the character and the tragedy of the background. So I just put myself into, you know, just put in my imagination in the booth. I went to this place and, you know, this dark kind of broody voice. You know, and I sort of found this character just in the audition, just improvising. And they essentially hired me on the spot. They'd seen over 500 people. And I found out from Andrea afterwards, the casting director.
Andrea Romano, who we love.
That I had been recommended by a New York casting agent, Anthony Borneo, who she knew. Because she said to Anthony, I'm going crazy. I can't find a Batman. We've seen hundreds of people. And he said, well, there's this really interesting New York actor who does classics, and he might be really interesting for you. So that's the kind of chance that wouldn't happen now, because everything's stunt casted now. Mm-hmm. Everything's about star casting. They were willing to look at an actor that no one had ever heard of, but who had the right instinct for the role and brought the character to life. I honestly don't think I would probably get the role today. And that's a sad thing about the way the business has evolved. Mm-hmm. But that was such a lucky moment for me, because it was also the first show where they broke away from that daytime, goofy, broad, cartoony animation that had been done while we were kids growing up. And they were willing to go to this dark, dramatic, epic film noir, incredible scripts, full symphony score, big cast of actors.
Yeah. I mean,
it was like doing a movie every week. It was such a huge departure for Warner Brothers. And the only reason they did it was because Gene McCurdy wanted to do it. And Bruce Timm wanted to do it. And Eric Rogomski and Paul Dini, all the people that got involved, were so excited about doing this, but they knew they were doing something revolutionary. It hadn't been done. And what are the odds that I would happen to be in LA? I was a New York actor. I happened to be in LA doing a pilot for a show.
That's the only reason you went in. If you were not in LA, you probably wouldn't have got this role.
No, I wouldn't have gotten it. So everything about it was so fortuitous. It was such an odd thing that happened. And then it led to, 29 years of being involved with this character.
How soon did your life change right after you got it? How long did it take before you noticed this is a difference? Something's happening.
A long time, because this was 91 when we started recording it. And we would do it in this funky little recording studio in Los Feliz, the Rowena studio. And we weren't even on the Warner Brothers lot. So we were like this little guerrilla group of performers, off on our own. And we didn't know what it was going to look like. Because, you do the voices first. You don't know for 6 months till it comes back from the animator what it's going to look like. So for those first 6 months, we didn't know anything of what it was going to look like. We saw sketches. But no one had any idea it was going to be all painted on black. And it was going to be this massive artistic endeavor with this full symphony score. And I didn't know that. So I was just improvising this character. So it was before the internet. So you couldn't Google Kevin Conroy or Batman, It was when voiceovers were still a very anonymous job. And I was used to it being anonymous. And I was cool with that.
Who is your favorite to work with in terms of you have favorites, but to other voice actors who you just really loved their passion and they were fun and it was easy? Besides me, who else?
You are my absolute favoriteest voice.
I didn't mean me. I mean even in the early 90s. I mean, you were working with Hamill, right?
To be honest, Hamill.
So much fun, right?
Hands down. You know this. Just a brilliant, crazy, complicated guy.
He's and lovable as hell.
Generous, no ego, gets in the way.
Yeah.
Loves other actors. One of my favorite images of Mark is looking over at him and seeing him watching the other kids. We're all recording together. And he's in the booth and I'm looking at him. And he's watching another actor perform and he's like this. He looked like a little kid looking in a candy store. He's like
excited.
This big grin on his face. And I thought, that's Hamill. He so loves actors.
That's so cool. Because most people don't do that, right? Most people are going, oh, yeah, come on. Yeah, well, it's my turn or something. Yeah. And he's cheering them on. It's a good thing to support your other actors, to cheer them on,
It's the right instinct to have because he knows that the better I am, the better he'll be. Because acting is reacting.
Yeah.
If you're getting a great performance, you have so much more to give, to respond to and to give to. And it will draw out of you. But if you're working with a piece of wood, someone who's giving you nothing, it's 100 times harder. You know that.
Is that why you called me Wood? Rosenwood?
Woody. That's why we call you Woody.
Wait a minute.
No, Michael, you are anything but Wood.
Well, I don't know. When you did when you did Batwoman, which was recent for the Infinite Universe,
Crisis on Infinite Earth.
Crisis on Infinite Earth. When they called you and said, Kevin, live action, we want you to be Batman. He's a bad, bad Batman on this world and in this universe. At first, were you thinking, fuck no? No. Immediately, what's the first thought that came to you? No. No, thanks.
Well, they didn't tell me anything about Batman. They just said he was the Batman in the future. He was old Bruce Wayne. And I said, you mean in Batman Beyond old Bruce Wayne? They said, well, no, he's not 80, but he's older and he's in bad shape. And
you're like, thanks? I mean, what the fuck?
Hey, man. they don't, they're so guarded with their scripts, the studios, as you know. Mm-hmm. They don't give them out. So they didn't give me anything. I got the script basically when I was about to get on a plane to fly to Vancouver to do the show. I hadn't seen anything.
But you said yes.
And I said yes because I was so excited to do something on camera again. I was so excited.
How long had it been?
25 years.
25 years? Is that sort of by choice? Or were you always pursuing that? Or did you just kind of say, I'm doing this. I love my life. I'll do plays. I'm not interested really in that. Or was it something like, fuck, come on.
I got a little bit older. Roles got fewer. And I moved back to New York because I had been living in LA for a while. Because as I said, I inherited a brother that I took care of. So he lived in Connecticut. And so I had to be near him. So that meant doing more theater. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get any on-camera work after that. It just stopped. So I started doing more and more voice work.
All right. So when you suit up as Batman and you're standing there on set, live action, are you nervous?
Oh, I was nervous.
Are you feeling things you haven't felt in a long time?
Oh, yeah. Well, what was weird about it also was they had that exoskeleton. Did you see it?
Yeah.
I was in this suit of armor, sort of, that was a external spine.
Right.
Because his back had been broken by Superman. And I didn't know that was going to happen. So this was full of surprises. I didn't know I was going to try and kill Supergirl. He was dark.
Didn't you kill Superman on that universe? Didn't you kill Superman?
Yeah. The fans were not happy about it. They didn't like seeing that version of Bruce Wayne.
But they liked seeing you.
But for me, it was fun. It was a lot of fun to sort of stretch my acting chops a little bit.
Do you want to do it again? Are you ready to
go? I would love to.
Yeah.
The producer was great. The cast, Ruby Rose, everybody was fantastic. Wonderful to work with. But they do like a movie a week.
Yeah.
It's a massive undertaking. Mm-hmm.
Quickly. You know, we didn't really talk about Robin Williams, but, you know, you roomed with Robin Williams. You almost roomed with Christopher Reeve. It was too expensive. I met him, an unbelievable man. I mean, a genuinely real Superman.
He was an angel.
And you almost roomed with him, but it was too expensive. He was rich.
Did I tell you that?
No, I think I read it.
You read it?
Yeah.
Where do people find this stuff out? I don't tell anyone this stuff.
Well, obviously it's true. Everything you read is true.
I hear this stuff in interviews. People tell me things about my career or my life, and I think, I never told anyone that. How did you know?
Well, you said it was a little expensive, so that's why you couldn't room with him or something like that.
Yeah.
That's all it was.
I so wanted that apartment. It was a floor through of a loft in Soho in 73. And it was something like, I think it was like 700 a month or something, or 800. And it would have been 400 each. And that was just way, way, way out of my league. I ended up getting a room in a rooming house for 150 a month. Can you believe that? On the west side of Manhattan. That was my first apartment, 150 a month.
Wow.
But I couldn't. There was no way I could swing it, but I so wanted to because he was an upperclassman and he was really cool. And, you know, he was part of the whole Juilliard.
Did he ask you to be his roommate?
I think he just put it on the bulletin board that he was looking for a roommate or something.
Right.
But when I saw the floor through of this loft and had these sliding glass doors, I remember it was so New York downtown dream apartment. I thought, oh, this would be so cool to have. But there was no way I was financially going to do it. So Robin and I ended up splitting an apartment with a couple of other actors.
So you lived and breathed like the same. I mean, you guys were eating together. Were you hanging out together? You and Robin, you were all working together.
We were all working together. We were living together. I was 17. I was 18, I guess, when I moved in with Robin. And he had already been through college. So he was like 22 or 23. And 5 years doesn't make a lot of difference between 40 and 45. But between 18 and 23, it's almost like a different generation.
It is, yeah.
I was so much younger than him in terms of life experience. I mean, he was doing stand-up mime on the steps of the Metropolitan Museum. That's where he would go on weekends to make money. I would have been petrified to do that at that point in my life. I just couldn't do that. And he was doing these performances during in school of these characters. He was a great, great, great character actor, as you saw in like Mrs. Doubtfire and Moscow on the Hudson. But that was really his strength was character work. And he would create these characters. At the age of 23, he did like an 85-year-old man, and it was totally convincing. He was lost in that man.
I also always imagine him, someone like me at the time, probably running around the house naked, doing goofy things, making everyone laugh. Was he like that? Because I remember I heard like on Mork and Mindy, he was always naked, walking around, opening his robe. It was a different time. He wasn't trying to be a perv. He was just trying to be a fun, stupid clown, you know.
Yeah, he was a clown. The thing about Robin that was a little difficult to live with is it never turned off.
Never.
He was always what you saw. That was not something that he turned on. It was just the on switch was always on. And in the middle of the night, you'd wake up and you'd hear voices coming from his bedroom. And there'd be different characters in there. Like a whole family was in there. But it was just Robin. And he was just having these conversations with these characters. He couldn't turn it off. And that got to be hard to live with.
Do you think that was hard for him, too? He knew it?
Yes. Yes. I think the reason he couldn't turn it off was because he was much more comfortable in that skin than he was in his own skin. It was hard for Robin to just be Robin. I found. There was one night. He left Juilliard early because of a very, very dramatic breakup with a girlfriend in California. And he ended up leaving. And he would have these five-hour phone calls with her in the middle of the night. And that was back when you were paying, you know, Ma Bell by the minute. So this was insane, what was going on. It was really insane. And the night that she split up with him, he had a meltdown. And I saw all of that performance, bravado, manic energy melt. And he became this shaking, keening child. This sound was coming out of him that was like, the only word I can think of is keening from the Irish plays. And all I could do was hold him. And just hold him. There was nothing I could say. He was shaking. And I realized he was losing control. And I thought, this is the closest I've ever seen him be honest, be him. He wasn't performing. And I was holding him like you would your son. And I was afraid to let go. I was afraid what would happen. Eventually put him to bed. But that was the most intimate moment we ever had. The most honest moment we ever had. And we never spoke of it after that because I think he was embarrassed.
I could see that because every time you see him, he was always on, always, always on. And that was a moment where you're like, he doesn't have control right now. This is the first time in his life. And it was nice that you were there for him. All right, this is really quick. This is the end. This is, by the way, this is, to me, this is one of the most extraordinary interviews I've had. No, it is because you have touched me and you have made me really think. And your stories, I'm captivated by them. I could see these certain moments in your life, whether it's Robin or whether it's your father or whether it's the play when you're having a fight with Brian or the profound thing he said or when you first got Batman. It's for the first time I think that I'm really like. I'm so lost in it that I feel like maybe this is my true first episode of where I feel like I'm really inside of someone. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Okay. It's called shit talking questions. These are just my patrons or patrons. There's a thing called Patreon and they get to ask questions. So this is spitfire. You just hammer them out. Ashley G, this is easy. Would you do more live action roles like the crossover or just stick to a lot of mostly voiceover acting?
Oh, no, I would love to do more live action. I would love it.
Ryan C, inspirations. did you use for voicing Batman? Now you talk about, you know, Shakespeare and things like that, but what were your real inspirations? Was it just kind of off the cuff?
It was so off the cuff. It really was. It was just, but in terms of inspiration for a lot of the role, because Bruce Wayne's issues are with his parents. They're unresolved issues. And I have to say, I have gone back to moments in my childhood with especially my father, who I still have a lot of emotion for. It was a much darker moment with my father when I was about 16, where he tried to kill himself, and I was the one who was sent to identify him and talk to the police and pick up his car and stuff. And it was a very emotional night for me. Very, very emotional. It took me a long time to get past that. It was very bloody. And I've gone there periodically in recordings. In fact, I did at one point, and Andrea stopped the recording, and she came into the booth. You know she doesn't do that.
No.
She put her arms around me, and she said, "I don't know where you just went, but it was unbelievable. Are you okay?" Because I was just weeping.
Wow.
I said, yeah, I'm okay. She said, "I don't think so." She said, "Let's take a break, everybody." You know, Andrea doesn't ever do that.
When she loves you, it doesn't matter. I have always felt that with her, that I could call her right now and her and Rogerio would just be there in a second. You know, they've come to Thanksgiving dinners and people are like, "Who are these? This is Andrea and Rogerio. Who the fuck do you think it is?" But that's amazing. And I think that most of the great actors, probably the great actors, have something to, you know, maybe that's why we had such dysfunction. If we didn't have things in our life that happen, you wouldn't have gotten Batman. You wouldn't have been able to emote all these things. But maybe on the flip side, you would have had a really healthy, happy, fun childhood, and you would have worked as a teacher in Westbury, exactly. And everything would have been fine.
That'd be a pretty nice trade-off, actually.
You know, and I think that, too. I'm like, you know, Lex Luthor, oh, my God, you know, and I've certainly tapped into a lot of dad stuff with John Glover, who you worked with, who we love, sure. And you tap in. And when you can tap in, it is something special and something really hard sometimes, and it just brings out
God
a lot.
I have done so many shows together through the years. First thing we did was a Kennedy miniseries. I played Teddy Kennedy, and he played one of the family, extended family people. It was with it was a huge cast for the BBC and CBS. Big miniseries with Martin Sheen and John Shea and Blair Brown. It was a great cast. And then we did the George Washington miniseries with another massive cast. And then we did a production of Measure for Measure, Much Ado, at San Diego Shakespeare Festival. And then Lear, he played Edgar and I played Edmund. And and then of course all the Batman stuff. I've known John for like 40 years. What He's crazy.
All right. Stephanie, besides Batman, what other roles would you want to pursue?
Where do you start? I'd love to play everything. I wouldn't know where to start. I mean, you know that. Actors want to do everything. I had the most wonderful thing happen recently. Paul Dini and Alan Burnett have started doing a new incarnation of Batman the Animated Series comic books. They've come out with a new series of comic books. And they asked me to do a live reading of the first issue.
Didn't you just do that?
I just did it.
Yeah.
I said, "Well, which character?" And they said, "Well, would you do like a reading of all the characters?" And I said, "Oh my God, would I love that? I would love that." So I did the cover to cover reading of it, playing all the characters. It was so much fun.
Wow.
It was like an actor playground. It was so much fun.
That's glorious.
Dulcie Bader, Dietrich's wife, sent me an email after that, and she said, "We really love your drunk socialite." She was great.
Roxy, who was influential in your life, your choice to become an actor? Maybe that's two questions, maybe it's one.
It's an interesting story. When I switched from Catholic schools, which I had gone to as a kid, to public schools because we moved to a different town. They didn't have a Catholic school. I was very, as I said earlier, I was a very uptight kid. I was a nuts, basically because of my home, but also because of the school. I mean, we had, you know, it was all school Catholic, where you wear a uniform every day, you do everything to clickers in the hallway. It was very nuns in full habits. It was very old school, mass every morning. And I suddenly was thrown into this crazy public school, and I couldn't adjust. I could not adjust. I could not function. I didn't know how to function. And they didn't know what to do with me. They thought there might be something wrong with me. And they were suggesting my parents send me to some kind of remedial school because they thought there was something wrong with them. And this English teacher assigned us Julius Caesar. This is in seventh grade. And I went home and I'd never seen a play. I'd never read a play. I didn't know anything about the theater. I read it. I sat down. It was like I understood what Shakespeare was saying. I just got it. I'd never even seen Shakespeare. I'd never seen iambic pentameter. It was weird.
That's weird because
And I came in the next day and I was exploding, ready to talk about it. And I came in with all this energy. And she said, wait. She said, why don't you come to my last period class? It's an advanced placement class. I want you to get involved in that conversation. So I came to her last class and I was like taking over the room. No, Brutus was saying this, and don't you know what this means? And she said, I want you to come with me. And she took me to the guidance counselor. She said, I am going to suggest we put him in all advanced placement classes. I think we have not understood this yet. And I also want you to audition for the school play. Her name was Joyce Wilkes. She was an English teacher. Joyce Wilkes.
Wilkes.
She saved my life. She saw something in me that no one else had seen. And she took that day, that moment, and said, we're putting you in different classes, and we're putting you in the school play. And I ended up getting the lead of the play, Our Town. And then ended up doing all the plays. And then it just sort of took over my life. I got on a stage, and where most kids who are 12 get stage fright, freeze, I suddenly, all my nervous energy, all my tension, all my anxiety that I felt in my home melted away. And I felt so at home.
Wow.
In that warm glow that comes on you on stage, I felt so liberated.
Theater saved you.
It literally saved me.
Yeah.
And I still feel that way when I get on a stage. I am so much more comfortable on a stage than I am off a stage. Off stage, I'm more circumspect and more
guarded.
Much more guarded. But on stage, I can do anything. I found that when I was 12. What are the chances of that happening? What were the chances of my meeting that wonderful teacher?
Think about things. Think about that. Think about what are the odds that you're there for pilot season and you just go and read for Batman. Look at the odds of all the, what are the odds? At that moment, Brian said, you know what? This is advice I'll give you. The one piece of advice you took from someone who was kind of volatile and you didn't really, you know, you loved him, but you didn't really, you know.
Yeah.
And these moments, in a way, they get you through. They help you. These little, he gave you that one moment, which was so huge in your life.
It resonated. For my whole life.
Yeah, and someone saw Mrs. Wilkes. It was Mrs. Johnson, who was Mrs. Paternoster, or Mrs. Meyer, or the few people, or the one casting director who believed in me. It's that one, those very few people which can change the course of how things go with your life. I mean, it's just incredible.
Isn't that amazing?
It really is.
I had him come up to me at the Chicago Comic Con. I've never forgotten this. And you've had this happen. She just said, can I hug you? I really have to hug you. She said, you mean so much to me. I said, of course. And I gave her a hug and I was figuring, you know, it was just a fan hug. And she started to cry, getting really emotional. And I said, it's okay, it's okay. I said, it's, she said, no, you don't understand what you did for me. She said, I grew up in the projects on the south side of Chicago. And every kid I knew growing up is either in jail, dead, or on drugs. She said, I got out because you were there for me every afternoon. Because my parents were working 2 and 3 jobs every day. They were not home. They were too busy trying to make money. And you were the safe space for me every day. And I learned so much from you. And she was putting that all into me, but it was Batman. It was the character.
Yeah, of course.
It was the show that we did. As an actor, you think, oh my God, the effect that you can have on someone is such a blessing. Because you know, you're so involved with doing the role, getting the role, performing the role. You tend to forget what effect it's having on someone and how something you do might save a child's life. Like that teacher saved my life.
Yeah.
As far as she was concerned, she was just doing her job that day. Or Brian, when he gave me that bit of advice, he was just, you know, tossing off a pearl of wisdom. He didn't know it would resonate with me for the rest of my life. We can all have such a profound effect on each other when we don't know it.
Yeah.
That's why you always have to resist that impulse to be short with someone. You know what I mean? To let your impatience get the better of you.
Yeah.
Because we're human. We all get impatient.
Sure. You know?
But you can't. You can't.
Yeah, and it took a long time for me. Not a long time, but I was appreciative. I was grateful, but there was a moment where I just go like, how could my performance, or how could something I've done as an actor help someone in their life? That doesn't make any sense. I'm just a show. It's just you watch it and so I couldn't understand it. But then slowly, when people who, you know, soldiers said, hey, our whole platoon in Iraq, we had the DVDs of Smallville, and that's all we used to watch, and it got us through, and you don't understand. Or someone says, hey, my dad, you know, that's all we had was our Tuesday night Smallville, and you know, he died of cancer, but that was our moment. And then I start to think about it, and it gives me goosebumps, like, wow, we do have an impact.
Oh, well, yeah.
And by the way, and it's when you know it, and you can do more. Well, if this has an impact, what else can I do to help? Because you can do, we just did an Omaze thing for Ronald McDonald House. Tom, Kristen, and I got together and raised a bunch of money for a change just because we were on a show. If it's that easy, keep it coming.
Exactly. You know? I did a series called Tour of Duty.
Oh, yeah.
It was a great show.
Mm-hmm.
Captain of the Platoon. It was the first Vietnam show on TV. And it really resonated with Vietnam vets. And I would, because I was the captain, I was the one who at the beginning of the episode would tell everyone what to do. And at the end of the episode would say, good work, guys. I wasn't in the middle of the shows, right? So I had a lot of downtime. So I would take advantage of that. And I would go do appearances for the VVA around the country at different centers. And the experience of being in these centers with these guys who were devoted to the show. There was one, it was either in Iowa, it was Iowa or Nebraska. And a guy, they were having a rap session, which they organized because I was going to be there. And we all talked about how the show was affecting them, with their experiences from the war. And it was just a talk. And this guy came in. And I saw everyone react when he came in. And I wondered what the reaction was. And he just sat in the circle. And then he suddenly started saying, you don't know. You don't know. You don't know what it was like. You don't know what I saw. I tried to stop him. I tried to stop him. And he just was back somewhere else. And one guy put his arm around his back, and then another guy put his arm around his back. And then I got up and started And we ended up making this huge cocoon around this guy who started wailing and broke down. And then the organizer, the guy who ran the Vietnam Center there, the vet center, took him aside with a group. And he came back to me and he said, "We've been trying to reach that guy for years. We could never get him to come in. We knew about it. And he must have heard about your being here today." And that was a major breakthrough for him. No one's ever been able to reach him. And I thought, the effect that the performances we do can have on people is so extraordinary. It's so humbling.
Yeah, it's also what I gather from that is, I don't know what I would have done. And it's like, at least I did something that can have an effect and does have an effect. And it's nice because I never thought I'd have an effect on anybody's life. So it sure is. Look, this has been extraordinary. I've learned so much from you. And I told you, I go, "No, Kevin, 45 minutes an hour. That's all I need." And then I just can't stop. I can't fucking stop talking to you. I love this. And I know people are going to go crazy because it's just real and visceral. And that's what the listeners want. It's not just a show where like, "Hey man, so tell me how you partied with someone." It's become this just kind of like how you get through life, and it helps people out there. You'd be surprised by your story. Will help so many people, just about your dad relating to that, or alcoholism, or whatever it is. It is, I really appreciate you.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Were you worried? Were you like, "Oh shit, Rosenbaum,
what's he going to ask me?
What is this?" Beautiful house, by the way.
Thank you.
What if it's a good set? All right, break it down. Let's break it down. The interview's over. Hey, Kevin, thank you for allowing me to be inside of you. That's what we say at the end of these interviews. And I wish you the best, and I can't wait to see you again. And I'll keep in touch. I'll keep bugging you.
Okay, great. See you soon.
Beautiful man. Honestly, I thought I was going to get emotional a few times when he talks about his dad. That moment with his father is just incredible. And the guy that was a kind of problem working with, and he gets this advice. It's amazing that you can even get advice from people you don't like. Or maybe he didn't say he didn't like him, but people that you might at the time, it's hard to work with. It's hard to do, you know. Got to look at the bright side of things, I suppose. You just do. Shout out to the patrons. Great episodes coming up. I told you some big news coming, and I can't wait to announce it. It's a really cool thing, and I hope it should be a great thing. And I just want to say thank you again for all the support and love. And I know it's I don't get political. Sometimes I mention things, but I don't do that. I think you want to get away from that. And if, you know, there's always that fear. People are going to leave if you talk political. Well, you know, no one wants to hear politics. I get it. You know, we are going, Rob Danson and I, thank you for watching our stage its, and we're playing music, and we're always looking for new covers and playing originals. And we'll be doing one in a couple of weeks. So look for that on my Instagram. Another virtual convention coming out. I'm on Cameo. If anybody wants a Cameo. I mean, you got to whore yourself out a little bit. I mean, I'm out there. This is what I'm doing. I'm at home like you guys. You got to figure things to entertain, things to do to keep your spirits up, keep them busy. I've had a lot of problems with my dog. Irv has had a lot of problems, and I've taken him to the vet probably, I don't know, 10 to 15 vets in the last couple of weeks, and from surgeons to the, and we're figuring it out. And then I realized, one of my friends said, "Do you think maybe he's just getting old?" And I go, "No, don't you dare. Don't, he is old, he's getting old, you know?" And I get upset. I'm like, you know, I'm like, "Come on, buddy, I think he's going to all of a sudden rip off his fur and it's a big super S in the middle and he's going to go, 'I was kidding, here I am.' He's old, man. I got to just, got to accept that, and I got to give him the best life he can have. And, you know, I just bought this thing to help him get into the car, you know, it's a pet loader, so-called pet loader. It's just like these little stairs that you just hold, you know, it's like a briefcase, but undoes itself. I can't. It just, when you open it up, they're like little stairs into the truck, and it helps them. And everybody just loves that dog, including me. I think that's what makes me the most sad is that, you know, when that time comes, I think everybody knows Irv. All my friends, my celebrity friends, my fans, my listeners, my everybody, my family. It's Irv. And I just lost my grandfather in November. And now I've got this old Irv dog, you know, trying to I hope he doesn't understand what I'm saying. For some reason, I think he gets it. He's like, dude, come on, man. I'm in the other room. Shout out to my uncle Warren, who has the pet show. Go to Warren Eckstein if you want to listen to some good stuff. If you have any pet problems, he's amazing. I've been watching this show Alone. Not alone. Well, I am alone watching a show called Alone on History Channel. I just love it. I started with episode 6, The Arctic, and I fell in love with it. And let's just say I loved it so much that I was emotional and I got a hold of the winner and said, you got to be on the podcast. And they said, sure. So the winner of season 6 Alone is going to be on the podcast soon. I'm very excited about that. Talk about someone facing adversity. All right, let me give the shout outs to Patreon. Thank you so much, Ryan. Cue that music, baby. How about a little Left on Laurel to take him out, man? How about a little bit of, I don't know, so whatever you want, man. Yeah, that one, Ryan. That's good stuff. Thank you guys again for listening to the podcast. I'm telling you, please tell everybody you know. Make them subscribe. Do all that stuff. Without you, I'm not here. And I like to be here. This has become my sort of, I don't know, it's my escape talking to you guys. I'm like Grizzly Man. Remember Grizzly Man? He recorded all this stuff with the bears and, oh, then he gets killed by the bears at the end. Yeah, let's not refer to that. Patreons, Nancy D, Leah S, Trisha F, Sarah V, Little Lisa Yukiko, Jill E, Brian H, Lauren G, Nico P, Barry I, Angelina G, Lee, Robin S, Jerry W, Emily K, Bob B, Robert B, Jason W, Stephen J, Kristen K, Amelia O, Allison L, Tom N, Jess J, Lucas M, Raj, Joshua D, Emily S, CJP, Samantha M, Hamza B, Jennifer N, Stacy B, Carly T, Jennifer S, Janelle B, Tabitha 272, Kimberly E, Crystal H, Mike E, Marissa N, Ramira, Beth B, Chris F, Sarah F, getting in sexy voice now, Chad W, Leanne P, Jackie P, Rodrigo S, Rachin, Ray A, Maya P, Megan D, Jennifer C, Maddie S, Tiffany I, Kendrick F, Ashley E, Margie M, Thomas T, Matt W, Belinda N, Benjamin R, Lisa J, Kevin V, Robert S, Nicole M, Amber F, James R, Chris H. You guys are amazing. All my patrons are amazing. These guys go above and beyond. Top tiers. Thank you, top tiers, for keeping the show alive. And, you know, I appreciate you. I got some new merch coming as well. So inside of you store, we've got great stuff. I just sold out of autographed mugs. If you want an autographed mug, they're available. They're coming in the mail any day, but we'll probably go through those pretty quickly. They went through quickly. Also got some other items and telling you guys on Patreon, the top tiers, you'll be getting some of these products, you know, cause there's merch boxes, the top tiers, you'll be getting these things. So you don't have to get them. I'm just giving you a heads up. So, guys, thank you for allowing me to be inside each and every one of you. Spread the word, and thanks for tuning in. I hope you continue to do so. I'm here if you are. So, thanks.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.